Hey, kids, what time is it?
The future is coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming
yeah.
on.
It's... And it's coming on hot today. Boy, it's like 80 plus degrees here in Boulder Creek. I guess that's nothing compared to a lot of the country. But it's going to get up to 88 today, Fahrenheit.
Yeah. We're not being baked. We're just being cooked.
No, cooked, yeah. And Bobby, how's it in San Francisco?
In the high 70s here.
Oh, okay. So you must have a clear day then.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful day. It's
We should come to San Francisco.
Yesterday, you know, it was overcast just... Yeah, it was a San Francisco day yesterday, but San Francisco summer where it's like the, it's the coldest part of the year. It's in the summer here.
Overcast just by thinking about it.
Right. Exactly. But no, today is wonderful. Yeah, perfect day. No clouds in the sky. It's amazing.
Are you going to talk about a humanoid robot?
Yeah, we love robots.
We love robots.
Can't wait to get our home humanoid. Now, one of the biggest categories are the humanoid robots. And the humanoid robots are quite advanced these days. They're getting more and more so.
Yeah.
Performing live surgery now. Looking at how can these humanoid robots do live surgery. And if you had a humanoid robot, you could drive your car, it could do cook your meals and stuff like that, but doing surgery the home robots probably won't do that, but they're using these humanoid robots now for live surgery. This is a story about how a robot removed a pig's gallbladder with standard surgical tools in an ordinary operating room. So this was kind of a breakthrough for the humanoid robots. The robot was named Sergi. It's not autonomous. It's not like it's just doing the operation by itself. It's more like it's doing the operation with the help of a real surgeon, a remotely operated robot. It was mostly being operated remotely by a human. The feedback from the surgeons afterwards was positive. They had less physical strain. They had less frustration. They liked the overall performance of the robots. They pointed out to practical problems like they had to constantly reposition the robot. The surgeons think that this could be a very useful tool as they evolve. The idea is that you could have these robot surgeons in remote communities where it's hard to get a surgeon. Canada has got a lot of places like that.
Now, I take it the big news here is not that robots can do surgery, because, of course, that's been happening with I think there's a machine called a Da Vinci that does some kind of medical procedures. Mm-hmm. And I remember reporting on one a long time ago that does tattoos, so that they've got that precision down with the robot arm.
The robot tattoos, yes.
But this is a humanoid robot that's being trained to be a surgeon.
Yes. Isn't it remotely controlled, though?
In this case, it is, yes.
You know what the interesting study was? They found that surgeons that know how to use chopsticks actually perform better remotely with these remote-controlled robots.
Really? Surgery. So yeah, chopsticks is a good precursor if you want to be a robo-surgeon, huh?
Well, how does that work, Bobby? Is that the nature of the hand that they have on some of the more primitive robots?
Because think about it. You know, these remote-controlled robots that you're talking about, the surgeon has to wear a special glove, right? And he has to have really good dexterity. Mm. And apparently, they found that these remote robots, the surgeon that had used chopsticks, like growing up using chopsticks, had really better dexterity and can actually move the remote scalpel very precisely.
You know, that makes a lot of sense, because you develop a lot more of your brain cells around how to delicately hold things if you're using chopsticks.
First of all, if you're dyslexic, you're even better, because then you're ambidextrous.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the part of the brain that has, let's say, you know, if you can map out areas that have sensitivity to the thumb and the first fingers and each finger, people that are dyslexic have larger areas of the brain, left and right hand. That's another thing. So they're very good with their hands. That was very weird.
Well,
I had a fortune teller tell me that I should do things with my hands. He wasn't saying I should be an artist or something. He just says you should do something with your hands because I'm very good at that.
Oh, good.
And
well,
I am.
Well, maybe you'll, before long you'll be using one of these robots.
Yeah, you'll be a chopstick surgeon.
Yeah. Well,
but you could be an artist, you know.
Yeah, you could. That's true, right? You know, it doesn't
or do things like that.
Maybe new forms of laparoscopic artistry might evolve out of this. The advantage of these humanoid robots, though, is that they're much more mobile and portable than the dedicated robots they're using now, like the Da Vinci that Sun just talked about, and that they are able to be dropped into locations quickly and easily in standard operating room.
Just push them off the helicopter and they're on.
Throw them out. Yeah. Oh, that's right. They're going down in the Congo with Ebola going on down there. Okay, drop off the robot.
Make sure they've got their bumpers on.
Typically, the surgeon is seeing this magnified, high-definition 3D view of the surgical field before him. And it's often better than what he would see with his own eyes. Da Vinci is particularly known for having really sharp visuals.
Boy.
It's pretty cool.
This is right out of a sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
This is the next chapter in abductions. Right? So now instead of being probed by little gray men, you're going to be probed by robotic arms in the middle of the jungle.
Yeah, well, as long as they can fix me. The cameras are held by the robot. They're steadier than what a human can hold a camera. So it's a more stable image that way.
I guess that counts when you're doing surgery.
Yeah, and these humanoid robots, they're very mobile. They're very compact. The electric components controlling their motion make them faster. They used to be kind of awkward.
I bet they still are kind of awkward.
Kind of awkward, yeah.
But they're probably very good at the cuts that they need to do.
Balance. The real world is complicated, and humanoid robots are, well, they are using, they work quite well in warehouses, in stocking warehouses, and actually, they've even been winning marathons lately, too.
Amazon is starting to use them.
Yeah, exactly. And Amazon's heading in that direction where they're a robot company, I think.
I remember when Wayne, one of his jobs was at Amazon, and he was actually competing with the robots to see who could do things faster. And it was really stressful for the humans.
They keep track of how long it takes you to do each task and over time, and they see what performance levels you achieve, and they compare different workers and, you know, choose the faster ones.
Well, the good news is that we're liberating humans from that kind of robotic work.
Right.
Robotic security. We still need to think about how to take care of the humans and support the humans in doing the things that humans do better.
Yeah. What do they do better? In this case, the surgeon is still there. He wears a stereoscopic headset with that 3D view I mentioned, and the robot translates the surgeon's commands into movements. Voice control.
Oh, you coax the robot, huh? Sort of like an episode of The Pit.
Yeah.
You're just telling the new robot apprentice how deep to wield the scalpel, right?
Yeah. Not so much. Slow down. I'll tell you. Right. Exactly. The team used the commercially available Unitree G1, a Chinese robot.
Mm-hmm. It's a humanoid.
It's a general purpose humanoid with a very relatively dexterous wrist. I doubt if it has anything on the level that the new Tesla Optimus robot will have, but it's got a fairly dexterous wrist and multiple joints.
So you can have the robot do some surgery and then go do the dishes?
Well, I guess that's possible. Right? Drive you home, to drive the ambulance too while you're at it. They also wanted it to be able to quickly switch between surgical tools.
Oh, mm-hmm. So it's going to have a rack of robot hands that it can choose from.
They optimize the hand for surgical instruments, which is kind of cool. I guess you can have detachable hands for different purposes.
Yeah, if you're a robot.
If you're a robot, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you could have one of the fingers or hands actually be a drill.
Sure, probably this one.
Let me take this off. Hey, look at that. There we go. All right.
It would be great for dentists, I guess.
Oh!
Oh, yes.
You better make sure you got plenty of laughing gas.
Dentistry is a whole other Magilla, man. They like these Unitrees because they're small. They're like 77 pounds. They're just over 4 foot tall, so they're just kind of like dwarfs.
Like 10-year-old kids or little kids.
They take up a lot less space than even a human. And the surgical robots take up a lot of space, the ones that are with all the arms on them. So
mostly it's the tray, though.
Yeah.
Once we get our, $20,000, $30,000 Optimus robot in our house, it could perform some of these things or help you with some of these things, Or, if you're older and you need an in-house nurse and pick you up and take you around and things like that. I mean,
Elder care is really good.
Everybody, because it's a lot less expensive to own a $20,000 robot than have an in-house care person taking care of you 24/7.
Well, it depends on how long. $20,000 a year maybe is cheaper, but not $20,000 a week.
These in-care house people, they're like $15,000 a month.
Yeah, like our buddy Taylor probably deals with that, right? He's 24/7.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you can rent these, not the Optimus, but the competitor to Optimus right now. I think it's less than $500 a month.
So if I was a home care person, what I would do is buy myself a fleet of, say, 5 robots, and then I'd park them in my patients' homes, and then I'd just visit the robots and my patients on a scheduled basis.
Now you're thinking the robot be able to handle all kinds of things. Like if you fall down, it'll be able to pick you up. Can wipe your ass. Do a lot of things.
Yeah.
But surgery does have a leg up on conventional surgical robots.
Sounds like a dog taking a leg pee.
Well, it can walk. It can walk. It's not a dog robot. It's a humanoid. It can fetch tools. Well, I guess that's a dog could do that, too. It can fetch the surgical tools. Good boy.
Are you saying it's only an arm, not a tail?
It's got a mouth, I guess.
Why do you think it has a mouth? What if it does? I mean, if it's an arm, it doesn't have a mouth.
No, that's right. I was conflating it with a robot dog.
That's what the future's all about. That's never right. What you expect.
Yeah.
Get ready.
Of course, we have to sterilize them, too.
Oh. Yeah. How do you do that?
Well, they don't say. They don't say exactly how you sterilize a robot.
The imagination runs wild.
But that's another surgical operation, I suppose.
Where were those tools before?
Who was using them? There you don't want them being picked up in the mouth.
They're going to design robots so that they'll have like a sterile solution inside their mouth. And so they will sterilize by taking a lick and then giving it to you.
That's possible, yeah. I guess you could put sterilization liquid as the saliva.
Yeah.
Right? That's what you're thinking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's better to have your robot be all sterilized all the time, right?
Yeah.
All of its liquids should be sterile.
Yes. So you always expose things to the sterilizer robot first.
Oh, you think it'll be a special robot that does the sterilization?
Why not? Why not? Could be,
It's a design issue.
Yeah. Look at the next story down, which is about this new tiny bead procedure for avoiding knee replacement. A lot of our audience probably has been thinking about knee replacements or hip replacements.
Okay, so I check daily, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a big deal to get a knee replacement. It's not a trivial operation. And it requires a lot of recovery and such. So,
and just about everybody our age seems to be getting them. They're handing them out like candy.
Yeah, they've gotten really good at it, but do you want to replace your knee or your hip?
No, I would like them to last for my entire lifetime and not be unhealthy.
Yeah. So short of that, if you could do a minimally invasive procedure instead of a replacement, would you consider that?
Well, like I say, if I'm in pain, I'm going to consider a lot of things. But,
I'm going to consider.
So far, my Hokas have worked really well. I haven't had knee pain. I just sprained my ankle, but my knees are fine.
Okay. Well, Leah Kasataban, MD, MS, Assistant Professor of Radiology at the University of Colorado, is very pleased with her operation. It's a procedure called genicular artery embolization. genicular artery embolization. And it's designed to ease chronic pain by reducing blood flow to the inflamed area inside the joint. And you limit the circulation to abnormal blood vessels linked to inflammation, and that can cause decreased swelling and hence decreased pain.
Oh, okay. So you deaden the knee a little bit so that you have less blood flowing
decreased
to
swelling,
it.
Decreased swelling, yeah.
Less swelling.
Yeah, and abnormal blood vessels often have too much inflammation. Usually the disease that they're treating is osteoarthritis in the knees. And right now they use medications, they use physical therapy, maybe a steroid injection. And then if none of that works, off with your knee. A total knee replacement. There hasn't really been anything in between until the GAE for genicular artery embolization. Minimally invasive that may fill the spot, you know, if you don't want to have to get the full knee replacement.
And so what are these tiny beads? What role are they playing? Are they clogging up the little blood vessels so doesn't get so swollen?
Well, let's go through the procedure a little bit. First of all, it's a two-hour procedure, and you're conscious during it. You'll have some sedation. And the procedure, they have a radiology team that make an incision near the crease of the leg, and then they insert a thin catheter through the femoral artery using X-ray imaging and a contrast dye. Once it reaches the genicular arteries around the knee, these tiny beads are released to block blood flow to the abnormal blood vessels associated with that inflammation. And those are the painful areas. They say 70% of patients have phenomenal results. It cuts their pain scores in half, sometimes more. Some patients have no pain at all after the procedure.
So they're not replacing anything. They're just cauterizing an inflamed blood vessel.
Well, they're putting these tiny beads in there. I guess the beads limit the circulation flow. This process was developed in Japan originally, interestingly enough. The four-year study that was published in Japan showed that if you have one outpatient procedure, your pain relief can last 4 years. In the U.S., there's a two-year study, and there's been a good response to that for 2 years. Osteoarthritis affects other joints, and so they're thinking about whether or not it could be useful for, like, frozen shoulders, tennis elbows, plantar fasciitis.
All right. Thank you, SciTech Daily.
Yeah.
You know, they're talking about this lizard venom. It's actually the history of GLP-1 type drugs, you know, the ones that...
Reducing weight.
Right? Reduce fat and weight and causes weight loss. It actually came out of lizard venom is actually how it was derived from originally. And they're saying these types of drugs can also repair cartilage eventually. You can also use PLP, you know, the plasma, you know, that they take and re-inject the area with stem cells. It actually is better than that. There's these new peptides also that are coming out that can repair the knee too. I'll have to find that one. I'll send that one to you too.
Oh, okay. There's a lot of work going on knees and pain that we'll keep tracking here. Yeah. You, Mrs. Future, had a problem with your ankle.
Yeah.
And a simple thing, just falling down once can cause pain for months.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, when you start messing around with your ligaments and your fascia and your bones and you get little micro fractures and inflammation and swelling, there's a lot of things in your foot that they're very tightly woven and there's not a lot of room for error. And so when something like that is healing, I think what's happened to me is that I was a little too aggressive in some of my therapies and I maybe re-injured it a little bit because there seems to be some long-term inflammation that now, 4 months later, I'm treating with, you know, putting ice on it to keep the swelling down. So,
yeah,
healing is a delicate art.
Space news.
Ooh.
Astrobiologists have positively identified something sweet in outer space. Sweet. Really? Yes.
They sent out something to do some taste testing in outer space.
Yeah. They went out and they found something real. So they pinpointed a type of sugar called erythrulose.
Like sucralose. It's erythrulose.
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 Erythrulose. Yeah, it's like Earth, but it's not. It had nothing to do with Earth. It's an inside a molecular cloud near the center of the Milky Way of our galaxy. Yeah, a sweet cloud near the center of our galaxy.
I see. So yes. They're getting this from spectral light data.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, almost everything we learn from outer space is through light.
Yes.
One form or another.
Because every chemical has a light signature.
Light signatures are profound.
And some of those chemicals are sweet, even if we can only see them with our eyes. A little synesthesia there.
Or with our instruments.
With our instruments, yes. Right. Erythrulose.
It's a 4-carbon compound. It's most often found in sunless tanning creams and, curiously enough, raspberries. And why is this important? Well, life as we know it is built on sugar. The biomolecules are integral to our metabolic processes. They serve as foundations for DNA and RNA. And biologists still aren't quite sure how the first sugars developed. You know, how did these appear on Earth? What were the planet's prebiotic conditions billions of years ago that led to sugar? They don't really know yet. We have not seen substantial enough amounts of the sugar molecules in prebiotic Earth.
Well, you know what makes a sugar molecule is just a long chain of available hydrogen atoms. We've got a universe that we know is about 90% hydrogen in some form or other. And the earliest planets were all those big blue giants were all hydrogen planets. It sort of makes sense that sugar would have been the first thing that happened when life became alive, because sugar is
energy,
a fundamental building block. Yeah, it's at the base of everything.
Yeah. Astronomers have detected sugar like glucose and ribose inside asteroids and meteorite fragments, suggesting that life on Earth received a little sweet encouragement from deep space.
The younger version of Interstellar Atlas, 3I Atlas, was here when we were just a little baby sun, and they came with some syrup from the center of the galaxy to feed our baby star. And they left some of it on our planet so that the star would have some in case it got hungry. If it ever eats any of our planets, it'll get some of that early star sugar.
You wonder whether or not planetary systems have a sweet tooth.
I never did wonder that until right now.
I see. And not just biological life likes sugar.
As above, so below.
Chocolate for planets.
I've discovered the best, this is absolutely the best sugar substitute you should put in all your drinks or everything that you normally we're using sugar for. It's an essential molecule. It's called glycine.
Oh yeah, you turned us on to glycine. That goes into many of our morning drinks these days.
Is that is that considered a sweetener? Is it glycine?
Use it as a sweetener. It's amazing because the sugar, it causes aging. Some of the synthetic sugars can cause dementia eventually. Glycine is so important in all the chemical processes. And it turns out, just for your body, for your mitochondria to finish executing all these chemical processes to release those electrons so that you have energy in your cells, it consumes a lot of glycine. And so we're all deficient in glycine. The big rage was using NAC, N-acetylcysteine, and that promotes NAD inside the mitochondria to give you energy. But it works 10 times better if you just introduce it with glycine together. So it's called GlyNAC. So you take glycine plus NAC and you get this word GlyNAC. And that's the big rage right now for anti-aging. It gives you energy at the end of the day. It's crazy. Like, you know, before, at the end of the day, if I was climbing up the stairs, it's like I was completely out of energy. And now it's like I just woke up in the morning. I have all the energy I need. And it just continues energy all throughout the day. Sprinkle it in your coffee or your tea. It's great in green tea.
You've been using it for how long now, Bobby? It's been a regular part of your life?
I heard about it during COVID because these people that were getting long COVID and they were out of energy, they found out if they added glycine, not only did they have more energy and they could sleep better, you can take it before you go to bed and you have better dreams.
Yeah. Fantastic. Wow. So far, so good. Eh? Years later, you're still doing it on a daily basis.
Now even more. And because of the big rage, I would say in the last 6 months, I've like tripled the amount of glycine I was taking. I mean, I wasn't taking that much before, but now it's like I like the taste of it. It's in everything that I put in. Yeah. You can just take hot water and just put some glycine in it and drink it. It's like sweet water. It's great.
Meanwhile, we got some sugar discovered in space.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they figure that in order for life to form as we know it on this planet, we needed maybe as much as 50 million tons of sugar that must have hit the Earth about 4 billion years ago. Maybe it came from one of these sugar clouds. It was during a formative cosmic era known as the Late Heavy Bombardment. The Late Heavy Bombardment, between 4.1 and 3.8 billion years ago. And that would have been enough sugar to assist in the development of the planet's first replication metabolic processes that led to life. Detecting of this
Erythrulose is very exciting. Who's Rith? You're Rith.
You know, and I took Latin in high school, too.
Loaf.
I took Latin in high school.
Yeah, but you must have forgotten everything you ever knew.
No, I
didn't. Well, not everything you ever knew, but all the Latin.
Yeah, or something. I didn't learn how to pronounce that. Anyway, it was very exciting because it opened up the possibility that there's other space sugar out there, like ribose, which is part of RNA. And they're thinking, you know, RNA ribose is very important for the origin of life.
All right.
Okay, so sugar in space.
Sugar in space and everything nice.
Interesting story. You know how radiation has been a big issue on this planet? SciTech Daily had an interesting story on how small bacteria have turned toxic uranium into a stable compound.
Oh.
Yeah.
So we got something that likes to eat uranium, huh?
Yeah, that bacteria may offer an unexpected way to immobilize uranium in contaminated water.
Oh.
Uranium contamination is difficult to manage because metal can change chemical form. And when uranium remains locked inside minerals, it's not very mobile. But when environmental condition or mining activity converts it into a soluble form, it can move through groundwater and spread, causing contamination. This new study suggests that naturally occurring bacteria may be able to stop that movement of uranium contamination. That microbes living in water from a flooded uranium mine removed nearly all of the dissolved uranium and converted much of it into a stable compound. Very unexpected results.
I see. They ate all the energy, huh?
Yes. This work was done in both Germany and Spain, published in Nature Communication, and they turned mobile uranium into what they call a more stable form, a chemical form of uranium that was not spreading everywhere.
It looks like, you know how gold is very heavy and uranium is much heavier than gold for the amount of space that it takes. And it looks like these bacterium are collecting it and concentrating. And if you look at the bottom of the picture, they kind of fall down to the bottom and collect like gold dust at the bottom. So if they flood the mine and the uranium is floating through the water, the bacterium is collecting it. So these bacterium are very heavy and concentrated. It seems like they make them immobile by just falling down to the bottom of the well. And so just like you collect gold at the bottom of a stream, it kind of sinks to the bottom. I think that's physically what's going on, is the bacterium is collecting it. Do you remember Paul Stamets was also saying that he found a mushroom that collects uranium also?
in these experiments, bacteria converted dissolved uranium into a solid compound, which I guess that's why it would sink to the bottom. They did this after receiving glycerol as a food source. Glycerol is a component of plant and animal fats that can also form naturally when fungi decompose wood. So they enter what they call a pentavalent state, or uranium-5, which is considered rare and typically short-lived under normal environmental conditions. This goes to show that microorganisms continue to be major drivers of chemical change in soil and groundwater, and they can process metals and other pollutants as part of their metabolism. And considering these microorganisms as a way of dealing with pollution is a really good idea.
We should really learn to love the microorganisms so that we can get them to help us eat the toxins.
Yeah, they can get rid of the heavy metals, which are toxic to us.
Yeah. If we love them, then we can feed them what they love. Maybe they love this stuff.
Well, I think it's loving them and knowing how to apply them properly, you know, to the situation. Feed them right.
Yeah. Give them what they love.
I think this is what they're probably going to apply to some of the vaults in that were storing the uranium that were blown up in Iran. They're worried about contaminating the groundwater there. Yes. So it seems like they would flood these things and put these microbes in there, and then the microbes would collect the uranium and concentrate it instead of letting it flow through the aquifers around that area.
Yeah, yeah, I think we should go to Iran and introduce this to them.
What was that? Ba-dum-bum. You got some microorganisms in the kitchen clanking around.
They're pretty big organisms in the kitchen, yeah.
There's an experiment with what's called an auxilium AMP-1 bioprinter that can manufacture kidneys and livers and cartilage tissue. If they print in space, they're able to get that intricate arrangement of cells much more evenly dispersed. Well, on Earth, the cells in the bioprinter don't quite print evenly. They the heavier aspects of a cell sinks to the bottom, so to speak, to a collection of cells where it's not dispersed and causes the artificial kidney or the bioprinted kidney or liver to not work as well as they should.
Those are the ones that are grown on Earth.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's a new experiment. It suggests that microgravity can help overcome this reproduction problem of cellular organization. Scientists use living cells in an ink, a special kind of bio ink, to build biological structures, and they sink in the ink, the components.
They have to kind of sculpt it, right? Yeah. They put the living cells into a little matrix and let them grow in a particular shape.
Scaffolding, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, scaffolding.
Microgravity can help spread cells more evenly throughout the printed tissues. Hmm. We can solve that problem of having a shortage of livers and kidneys in transplantation, a big bugger.
So they weren't able to actually produce any usable kidneys with this, but they did learn something.
They did learn that they're able to print better cellular structures.
Hmm.
They compare it to like blueberries sinking to the bottom of a muffin batter before it bakes.
Hmm.
And if the cells are unevenly distributed or end up in wrong locations, that's it for the tissue. It doesn't function as well. Maybe that's where we'll get them from. They'll be imported from the space station. You know, when you need a kidney. Yeah, they're pretty cool. The researchers from the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine supplied human kidney and liver cells with tissue designs. And the bioprinter firm Auxilium provided the orbital manufacturing platform capable of producing tissues in microgravity.
Hmm.
Kidney, liver, and cartilage tissue using specialized bioinks with living cells.
Hmm. I'm applauding this kind of research. It's way better than enslaving future humans and using them as organ farms.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of the Dark Ages.
That's where we're going with Baron von Harkonnen in Dune.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's good news for
this week.
That's
good news.
Yeah.
So since I want us to kind of bring the show to a close here, I wonder if we couldn't come up with some kind of a what the future ending where we contemplate some rad aspect of this week's news.
Well, here's one thing. We'll leave on a collection of images of Pentagon releases of the latest UFOs.
All right.
UAPs,
okay? Unidentified flying objects.
Yeah, all the latest stuff.
Let's go.
See what you think.
Okay.
Okay.
comments. Welcome.
So is there a new dump of...
Yeah, there's a new dump this week. The one I have up now is probably one of the more unusual ones.
Looks like a flying camera. It looks like a drone. Doesn't that look like a camera on a drone?
Yeah, that's probably the most interesting one. The Imperial forces looking for the Rebel Alliance on the planet Hoth, you know, in the Star Wars series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So don't you feel like the Pentagon is doing their best to just release things that make us want them to take care of it? Oh, look, it's technology.
Some people think it's a bunch of balloons that escaped.
I think it's a bunch of insane patients that escaped.
Yeah.
And right, now they're running the government.
And we'll show a few other cool stuff on the way out here.
Okay. All right. Well, the future's calling me, people.
All right. We must get rolling. Yeah. So until next week, folks, enjoy the show. And we're also processing a really interesting interview with Randy Masters, which you'll be seeing soon, too.
Stay tuned. Yeah. And
thank you, Bobby.
Always wondering.
Good to see you.
Yeah. What the future.